Rainer Maria Rilke has written a poem called Sense of Something Coming. I am like a flag in the center of open space. I sense ahead the wind that is coming, and I must live through it while the things of the world still do not move. The doors still close softly, and the chimneys are full of silence. The windows do not rattle yet, and the dust still lies down. I already know the storm, and I'm troubled as the sea. I leap out and fall back and throw myself out, and am absolutely in the great storm. It seems unusual to me that the lectionary for the season of Lent begins with a scripture that leaves us knee-deep in the residue of a great flood. Empires and history and affections and hopes and dreams and seasons and cycles and childhood and lovers and all the accomplishments of a life are lost in an unstoppable deluge. What a strange place to begin. And yet, on second thought, I have a feeling that this is brilliant. The editors have put their finger on the thing we fear the most, being swept away without fight or fairness or meaning, drowned in the deep as if we had never been. The flood story was a way of expressing the sensed anger of God. The writers, sensitive as they were, had a feeling that things are so profoundly out of whack in life, that the way we live together is so bruised that the God at the center of things, who willed something far more profound, is raging about it. The writer hears God saying, "You keep doing this. I warned you. I taught you. I showed you how. I raged at you. I pleaded with you. I gave you every chance, but you keep ruining the covenant of grace. So, there's going to be a clean slate, a brand new beginning, a destruction of all things that have come before. All my mercy will now be held in one small, frail craft that gathers a mere remnant of all living things to bob a while upon the waves." Is such judgment real in any way, do you think? Or is it just the stuff of storybooks? Is such judgment looming for us somehow, do you think? Are we still unmoved when we're shown the misery of the world? Are we still unshaken when we breathe the air of a corrupted planet? Are we still blasé about the imbalances that shackle our brothers and sisters in their lives everywhere in the world every day? Will no one say among us, "Enough is enough," and stand up with a life to make it stick? Now, rising waters will change the way we feel about things. I was thinking that as I thought this story through. At first we say, "Oh, rising waters. Well, there's more rain for the garden. That's a good thing. And we can fill up the swimming pool more easily. That's a good thing. And you won't have to keep bending down to put water in the dog's dish. The nature and the natural world will do it for us. That's a good thing." And then the rivers continue to rise. And we say to ourselves, "Well, that's a good thing. There's more scope for commerce to go up and down the streams, and there's more room for exploration. We'll be able to float to places we haven't been before." And then comes the tsunami, a deluge, the earthquake that eventually sinks Atlantis. I feel the water rising around my familiar faith these days. I was thinking about that, and at this age and stage of my life, it's a frightening thing. I preach the naivety of sweetness and goodness to you in some form every week, while the world seems to throw up ignorant leaders and populists who are anxious only to take the world in their own direction, ruining others for the sense of self-enrichment. They seem to be popping up as poisonous mushrooms in every election across the world. And in these days, I'm feeling shaken and unsteady about my faith. I came to believe that we have a natural bent in us towards goodness, and that evil is somehow an aberration in the human condition. It is brought about by people's lives that have been crushed or are full of raging that cannot be taken away. But now, just for the moment, I'm beginning to feel that everything is sort of neutral, that any choice is a choice, that we make choices in life depending on our sense of self, the way we were raised, our sense of ego, the way we have been bruised or battered, the way we want to get even, the way we want to climb to the highest rung we can attain. Circumstances change us, and I begin to feel a little foolish up here in this pulpit when I seek to delude and weaken my people with a gospel of love in such a world as perilous as this. So I'm sort of glad we're standing knee-deep in rising flood waters these days. It tells me something about the language of Lent. This is news of a great war that is raging among us, the war that was spoken of in the ancient scriptures. It's still going on, and it has the power to overwhelm us. It displays for us how much time we're spending on facing the reality of our life or denying the reality of our life. Does anyone think about the Middle East much anymore? Anybody think much about Syria anymore? That awful war is still going on. ISIL is still going on, but we don't read about it much in the newspaper anymore. So we think about the shooting in Florida, and we think about the elections and the rigging of them by the Russians, and we think about all the things that are on the front page. The other day I was listening to a radio documentary about a historian who lives in Mosul in Syria. When ISIS came and took over the city, he felt that he was responsible for keeping the true history of the city in front of him. And he went out at great personal risk to himself to film and to document all of the atrocities which the ISIS fighters were taking part in that city. And he said, "I saw things that were so violent and so ugly that I could not sleep at night. When I shut my eyes, I saw women beheaded and children murdered and neighbors turning on each other again and again, people I knew being slain in the street. And I couldn't tell anyone, and they were tracking my phones, and I took my life in my hand every time I walked those streets." And the interviewer said, "Why did you do it?" He said, "I am a professor of history. I love my country and I love my city. Its heritage is rich and ancient. And I know that if ISIL is to win the day, it will change the story of my city and make it sound as if Western powers attacked them in their righteousness. I can never stand for that. The true story must be told." That's courage. So the story of a rainbow is a gift for a man like that and for all of us who hope for more of a world. It is a sign of a reprieve. God's war bow, which brought the flood, if you follow the story out, is now placed at rest in the clouds above us. And in that gesture, the author of the story imagines God saying to us, "Well, here's a new start, and the seeds of your new life are afloat in this ark. The floodplain of evil is still out there, but above the floodplain, if you look, you can see the war bow of God now resting at peace in the clouds. When you see the rainbow, you will know that God will never again destroy the earth. I make a promise to you, says the sacred, to all generations, all over the world and in all forms of life, I will hold you, I will rescue you from the deluge, this I promise." The language of harsh reality is softened by a deeper one. It says that the bounty of goodness will always outweigh the dragging terrors of evil. The bounty of goodness will always outweigh the dragging terrors of evil. Lent also comes to us in the language of one great exemplary life living among the clouds as a rainbow with us. We look at the exemplary life and we see the rainbow of God and we find hope in ourselves. Jesus is the ark in the New Testament story, the one in which our true lives and destinies are floating in safety. Indeed, if you think about it, the Jesus story is one of a rising flood. Rome is invading, injustice is pervading, the persecution of the small and voiceless continues, violence and loss of hope seem to be everywhere around him. Jesus lived up to his neck in such rising, murky waters, we are told, and the cross sealed his fate, and he was drowned in them. But everywhere, in every generation to this day, people are hanging on to the ark of Jesus, holding tightly to the ropes and to the rails along the side, and they sing of rainbows, they dare to sing of rainbows, and they support each other even in the violence of the storms. Prayers in hospital rooms do it, hot soup in the kitchen does it, heartfelt conversations in the drawing room do it, sparks of inspiration and shared truths in the street do it. The flood floods, but the ark floats. This is our experience. I used to feel that we've made far too much of Jesus the man. I still believe that when you read the Gospels, we're not reading about Jesus the historical man. By the time the Gospels are written, Jesus has become the messianic instrument, the Son of God, the Superman, living in disguise in our midst and doing remarkable things. For me, the Gospels are more about what the church believes about Jesus than about Jesus of Nazareth, the historical man. For me, Jesus has always been a theological symbol, has always been a tool, a way for the church to focus and express its faith. If you want to know what our faith is about, let us tell you the story of Jesus and make it very, very particular, we say. He is the tangible icon of that vast human experience known as engaging the mystery of the sacred. You want to know what the big picture looks like? In our experience, it has to do with the story of Jesus. Look at the theological symbol and the icon of Jesus Christ, and you will draw nearer to the mystery. To see him human, day by day, in the streets, seems impossible for me, lost in history, and is certainly beyond the range of the texts we have. But you know, I'm shifting back the other way in my thinking these days. In a flood, I don't need a concept, and I don't need a theological premise. I need a savior. I need an ark. I need a human life living beside me with inner courage and a strong arm and a grounded hope. I need one who will rescue me from my immediate, personal, and communal despair. A week or so ago, a group of Chinese students came to us for the first time. They met with me later that week in my office, and I asked them to tell me about their story. They are young, persecuted Christians who had to leave China because they would have been arrested and imprisoned for their simple faith. One young man said that his father died when he was 6, and that he spent most of the rest of his time raising himself. "What happened to you to bring the power of the gospel alive for you?" I asked. He said, "I met a group of young Christians, and they took me to their church house, and slowly over time, they showed me the kindness that opened my heart. I felt I belonged somewhere for the first time in my life, and I drew strength from them. And it was then that the stories of faith and the texts of promise came to life for me." When I went to Scotland a few years ago, it was just after I'd had some measure of heart surgery. I wasn't feeling particularly strong. I wanted to go to a gathering of my clan, and my wife said, "Well, go ahead, you seem to be all right." So I took my medication and a light bag, and off I went to Scotland. I found when the wind was raised a little bit, I had difficulty dragging my suitcase across to my room. I wasn't able to climb the hill with the rest of them to where the dinner was being served, so I sat by myself at the bottom of a hill in a small restaurant and ate most of my meals. It was a little bit of a short walk here, a little bit of breathlessness there. They all gathered around me as best they could, and I was doing my best. I was very happy to be among my own and slightly worried about the condition in which I was there. But to my amazement, when our bus arrived in the very north tip of Scotland at the edge of John O'Groats, a rainbow shone from one edge of the Orkney Islands to the other, above our heads, to begin this visit with a great bow of God in the clouds. And it was a wonderful time together. I managed to climb the hills and get through it and take my medication and come back to Toronto. And as we got on the bus to leave John O'Groats, a double rainbow shone from the one end of the Orkney Islands to the other. Go home, be blessed, said the great God. The deluge shall not overcome you today. I still remember it. The particularity of Jesus, then, as the ark, is essential. Just as the idea of friendship always rests better when there's a friend, and the idea of the power of love is always focused better in someone who loves you, and a teaching rests in a teacher, and dreams are fostered by one who dreams. So the language of Lent speaks with an Aramaic accent for us, and that's fair. A distinctive voice in a particular moment of time. In their day, local people with all their real lives and all their worries saw in this human person that which gave them hope beyond the flood, and it happens through us as well. We meet a living figure and see in that figure the power of God to help us in the flood of our day. We witness to one another that truth when we tell the stories of our own faith. Well, in a few quick verses from Mark, I saw that the language of Lent is sometimes sign language. Did you notice how simple that text was when I read it to you today? Mark is the simplest of the Gospels and the earliest one. Indeed, I would say that Mark is the master of biblical tweets, the gospel truth in 140 characters. In his brief verses this morning, the ones we read, we see deep belonging, visceral temptation, the clarity of anchorage, and a call to know and love and serve the Lord in the world ahead anyway. Sign language is the simplest and most universal way we speak to each other. We all speak in sign language, whether we can speak each other's verbal language or not. We all know a spouse's knowing look, don't we? And we know one word that means another. Are things all right with you? Yes, things are fine. We know what that means, don't we? And we all know a conspiratory wink at a garden party. And we all know the quick nod of assent. And later on at home, we know the castigation when we miss the signal. What was the matter with you? I was signaling to you all through the event. When I think of it, all my relationships are soaked in sign language. Not only do we hear the words people speak, we watch each other's faces and each other's body language, whether they're leaning in or leaning out, whether they've fallen asleep halfway through your sentence, which is something preachers look for every day. We read each other as a baseball player reads the inning and the field and the opponents and the count and the coach and the crowd and the desire of the team. The shorthand of the sign language of Lent, then, winks at us to say, we're tight with God. Never forget we're tight with God. And whispers to us, I've got you in the palm of my hands, don't worry. And texts us with a look. Pay attention, it says. Live your life paying attention. I'm signaling to you all the time. Little tweets of eye, ear, and heart. And finally, a strong lunge into the future. It says, there's no deeper meaning, say the signs, than to follow. No time for retreat or hiding. Trust the ark. Trust the rainbow. Even if it's raining out there, walk into the future. I've got you in my hands. When I spoke about my wavering and my change of perception in the faith, just to a small group the other day in passing, one of them came to me later, very quietly, and said, I hear your concern today, and I worry about you today, and I want to tell you that the choir this morning is going to sing a wonderful anthem, and I was thinking about its words. So what I want you to do, she said, is in your imagination, walk to the center of the labyrinth in the chancel and sit down on the floor, cross-legged, in the center circle, and let the music and the words of this anthem flow over you. This song is for you. And these are the words. In this place, I have been made new. I have been gifted jewels beyond price. In this place, I am light. In this place, in your sight, I am made everlasting. You give me the strength for me to hold. You are the hope that shines like gold. In this place, I am new. In your love, I am true. Wasn't that a wonderful gift to give someone? It certainly was a wonderful gift to me. I feel that the flood is receding in the heat of a sun that has no sunset. The ark of Christ is riding close at hand even now, and the bow of God is visible in the clouds above our head. All the deep signs point towards a whole life, a complete life for us and for the world beyond the power of any deluge. This is the language of Lent.